And I'm Oliver Wyeth.
Welcome to the Present Group Podcast.
We sat down with Matthew Stella, the 14th artist for the Present Group, at his studio in San Francisco. Throughout the interview, we refer to various pieces around his studio. So for those of you listening at home on the CD, we've included those images on the CD. And for those of you listening on iTunes or on our website, we've posted the images on our blog.
We started off by asking Matthew about his process.
Well, I start with determining my, the scope of my project. Like I said, I pick the amount of layers for a Photoshop drawing. That's, the amount of actions and the size. And then I start building an image based on the previous layer or the previous decision. So everything kind of grows out of it. I never do a drawing where I start in the top left corner and pieces are in the bottom right hand corner while it's growing. It all comes out of this mass. It's kind of a growth. And that's why I think that a computer program could do it for me. It's just throwing, bits of information in a pile and watching them pile up. But obviously once I'm making decisions, then it becomes like a painting. It's like any other painting or drawing where you're making decisions based on your previous decision, and it just grows like that. That's where kind of the classical training that I went to school. So it's hard to unlearn, making, like a process. So that's kind of how I make the process. But it's really the end result that I'm most interested in, and I like unexpected results. So if I can get, throw something random into it, sometimes it's like, being ironic, like a hipster making choices. Like, this really looks bad, but there's something really exciting about that choice. So maybe.
So you think that some of your work looks bad?
No, I think it looks fantastic, but they're
bad in a good way.
Well, it's bad. It's like a bad meaning good. Like, it's nasty, but there's something really feels good about that. It's not even beautiful is a bad word to say too, because then what looks ugly to me is, or what would look ugly is beautiful, or vice versa, just because it's different.
Right.
Maybe different is a good word.
Yeah. The thing about like a computer making a painting like this is, wouldn't a computer just be random, it would just look like noise or something.
Well, that's,
it would never be able to produce that.
I know. Well, that's the thing, it's like you would have to program like a human touch into it, like program some rules, right? So I mean, that's what I'm basing on. Like, sometimes I can't just pile them off on top of each other. I'm like, maybe if I push this off to the side just a little bit, it'll look more interesting. So right there, that's a decision based on rules or aesthetics or something like that.
Right.
But so it would take a long time, I think. I think it could be done. It just, you have to program some humanness into it. But I think there would be a lot of, the benefit of a computer doing this would be, you'd get a answer or a finished drawing quicker. It wouldn't always be a perfect drawing. So I think you could do 100 of them and then choose one, because one maybe works and the rest don't. But I don't really know what works when I'm done with it anyways, because it takes so long to make these things, I'm stuck with it. Like, I spent, a couple hundred hours on a big piece like this, so it is what it is at that point.
Right.
I don't know. It'd be nice to be more prolific. And I think like a computer would help doing that. I mean, it's a freaking computer that does it anyways. It's just, a little bit of me.
A little more than a little.
Yeah.
It took a couple hundred hours.
Yeah, well, it's true. I mean, it's ridiculous. I want to show you around this thing, which, speaking of a couple hundred hours, this has been, it's about 2 years I've been working on this. Now, not very often. Not much straight time or constant work, but this isn't even anywhere near like the size of the scope that I, for something like this, but just a little cross stitch like this,
looks awesome.
Somebody could do this for me.
You can just
pay someone to do it.
And now I'm just doing the white. You know, and the white really has such a limited thing, but I've been working on the white for 8 months.
How?
I work a couple hours a week, you know, it's like in front of the TV.
But is there something, you know, about the craft of that?
Well, there's, I think that's another important thing, like where, what's the difference between printing something versus doing something with your hand?
Right.
And I don't know if I put more value in one or the other. I think it's just a way to make something happen. And if I have to do it by hand to make it happen, then that's what I do. If there's no way I would paint these prints on metal, it's just not, there's nothing I think I would gain by painting something like that versus stitching something like this. If I could, you know, I don't know, pay somebody to it, but that's still, you can't pay the amount of hours that it would take. This thing would be thousands of dollars. Plus, I can't sell it now for thousands of dollars either.
Why not?
I mean, I don't think there's, well, we'll talk the value question at some point, I think, but there's implied value in things like that. Like this homey, folky cross stitch thing, is it worth anything to anybody, first of all? And can you ever pay the amount of money that's worth the amount of time? Or at least at this stage, I mean, I don't have people buying any of my art, so the fact that you say, you know, a couple thousand dollars for this, they say, oh, very nice, and then they walk on. But that's kind of cool too.
Yeah.
You know, it's just doing things. I think that's the biggest thing for me, is just doing it. Since everything's done on the computer, I have to make it physical, or it's in that world, which it's kind of like a ghost there. I mean, it's like it's a specter. It doesn't mean anything in that form. It's just something you look at. Now this is a thing, but you know, is there something lost between this thing and the computer file? I mean, that's something that I'm always worried about. Like, once I'm done with this, it's going to be done. And then, you know, it's done and it's dead, or it is. It's like a relic of...
But you think that if it was on the computer, it wouldn't be?
I don't think it is anything on the computer. It's just a, like, you know, flickers. It's interesting to me, but no one sees it that way, and I don't like showing it that way. I think there's... It's important that it's not on a computer screen. I've never done anything on a screen, which, for good or for bad. I mean, I guess it could be on a screen, but that's just not the point. I think the point for me is doing something, producing it, making it.
Right.
And how it's made doesn't really matter. It's all just based on what the end result is. And it would be nice someday to be able to pay people to make the stuff. I mean, that's the dream.
Right.
Have a production house. You know, Jeff Koons, I mean, you look at him and he's got all these people that work for him and just make his stuff. It's just a dream. It'd be a dream, because it's all the tedious stuff that is not the art.
So for you, the process of making it is totally removed from...
Well, there's two making. It's like, you know, making the final product or making the drawing on the computer. And the drawing on the computer is...
The
thing I'm more interested in the process.
But you also want a computer program to do that.
I guess that's a problem. Well, maybe what I'm thinking is the balance or the contradiction. Like, there's a contradiction there, and I think that's interesting. That what if I made a computer make the drawings, but then I did them by hand?
Right.
So my hand was in it somewhere.
Right.
I don't know. Those are all still open-ended questions, but I think they're important.
Let's step back a little. How would you describe your work to someone who hasn't seen it?
And that's always the toughest thing, I think. The 30-second elevator interview.
It doesn't
interview.
Have to be 30-second, but you know.
I'm so bad at that because I'm self-deprecating in it, because I like to call it trashy in. Nasty, but those words to me mean, like, are good words to me. I'd say if I were just to walk in on a piece, I'd say it's like 8-bit, you know, old technology pixel art. I mean, there's obviously video game look to it. That's something that I can't escape no matter what, so you have to see it. But I think there's the production or the sign language, you know, these techniques that are used to produce these things, I think, are what is instantly noticeable. So it's video game meets, you know, physical product or object. Or computer digi trash. They're something visual that are turned into products. They're digital drawings or digital paintings. And they just happen to be based on low resolution and pixels. So I guess we're kind of feeling it out. Low resolution, pixel drawing trash.
For something like you did for the present group, can you take us through the process of what it was like to create it? If you take away, for now, the 3D aspect.
Okay. That is like a little extra special.
Yeah.
Projects are based on limitations for me, so I define my limitations. That's where we start. So it's analytical, and that's how I would start any drawing or painting, because that's what these are. So I decided my sizes. I decided the layers, the quantities. This was different because I had black and white and color, so it was 256 black and white plus 128 colors. So it ended up being 384 layers. There you go. So that was my
384 layers?
Layers of information. So that's how I built that drawing. So that's where I started. So then,
like Photoshop.
Photoshop layers. So when I say layers, it's all just, you know, bits that are thrown on.
Okay.
So then I start by accessing my cache of files. I have low res pictures and screenshots from video games. That is my base. I have thousands of these files. So I start bringing them up randomly and grabbing bits of information off of each one. And I grab those and throw them onto the drawing. Sometimes I leave them where they hit. Sometimes I move them if it's, you know, if I want to move it around and make it fit nicer. It's kind of like building a puzzle, and that's kind of what the drawing or the collage is. I do also draw with the mouse. I think there's lots of interesting and nasty things that you can do with the mouse drawing. So I basically build the drawing that way, and it's, like I mentioned before, it's a growth from a certain point. So wherever that first chunk hit, it kind of grows. It's like a mutation or cancer or something like that. And then I hit my 256 layers of black and white. And then I moved on to the color, which became another 128 layers. And after it, that was my limitations. I made sure that it was finished. Should we talk about the 3D?
Is each layer one sort of thing? Like in one spot?
One color or one...
I'd say one chunk of information.
One chunk of information.
So it's not a whole drawing that's thrown onto it. It's, you know, maybe one color selection from an image or a file, or one set of groups of pixels next to each other, or, you know, maybe it's just one line here that I reflect on this side too. A small amount of information, I'd say. So each layer is a small amount of information, and they build on each other.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes on these bigger pieces, I'll do bigger chunks of information since I have a lot of space to cover.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where you see like a screen-sized block of color or a shape. But it's limited. I don't take too much from everything. So you do, the more you look at these things, you find things that you would recognize or you think you would recognize.
Mm-hmm.
They don't always relate, but there's something about it there, and I try to leave it at that. Very limited information, but still has some sort of touch, so you feel like you're there's something familiar in it.
It's like your mind is trying to figure out what it is.
I tried to describe this to somebody, I think a couple weeks ago, about maybe it was Mike, about it, you know, it's like squinting at something. It's like you think you see this. You know, you think there's a lot more information there than there really is. I mean, these pixels really do represent a median or an average of everything that's contained in that little space. It's just, let's say it's a purple, and that's just the average color, you know, amount of information there. So really, you know, you have a picture of Oliver that's this big. You know, I don't think it's any less true than a picture that's this big. It's just everything is averaged out, and so those little pixels, they represent, you know, maybe a half of his nostril and a little bit of his cheek, but it's all there. All the information's there. It's just kind of working to figure it out. So you have to work a lot I think, to look at them. And I try to discourage by making it kind of nasty. And there you go. So
discourage what?
Discourage you pondering or getting stuck in it. I mean, I think the colors and the garishness kind of push you away a little bit. And at least it does to me when I'm making it. I'm like, God, this is something that feels really wrong. Like I said before, I really like discord. And I think it makes you look harder. If it was easy to see something, then you'd be done looking at the drawing quickly.
Okay.
And I think, although the pixelization, I think, sometimes takes away from, you know, the dynamics of a drawing. I mean, you're always dealing with a jagged line. Like, this curved line here is always going to be jagged because it's these blocks and they're very solid. But that makes you slow down while you're investigating it. If this was one quick arc, one line, your eyes would go for it a lot quicker. The fact that it's broken into these segments, you go really slowly through it, I think. Or you just, you know, don't even look at it. You just leave it be and walk by. So I think it takes a certain person. I think it's, you know, I grew up in the 80s. I think people that have that are used to seeing like a pixel or a screen. You know, you will have more appreciation for it than, you know, somebody who hasn't looked at a screen their whole life.
Right now, a work that incorporates pixels can be seen as referencing the birth of computers, basically.
Yeah.
Like, but as younger generations grow up in a world where computer screens weren't like that pixelated,
yeah.
Do you think that pixel images will just be like another style choice?
Yeah.
Or are they already?
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, they become a style choice like that, definitely. And they do reference those type of things for us. I can't imagine people that, you know, are born in, you know, this decade and like what they get to see. I mean, still, let's say Facebook, for example, your photo on Facebook is still this big. You know, people are still looking at devices this big.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything is still going to be limited by that to some extent. There will always be pixels. I mean, you will always keep zooming in on an image. Like, oh, maybe I can see a little bit more. Until you get cameras that are so ridiculously, you know, high resolution, and memory is not a, you know, like, no, you know, you have a glut of memory, then you could maybe have perfect resolution forever, or maybe not. I don't know.
Right, maybe you can't. That's the limit. That's always the limit. Like Google Maps, when you keep zooming in, it's just,
you can't zoom. There's always, you know, an end to a zoom. So these are, let's say, you know, maybe this is some like microscopic part of, you know, some person or something like that. I don't know. Maybe these are molecular.
Do you always pull images from games and things like that? Or do you also pull, you know, blow up photo images or something and take pixels from there?
It's either stuff off of the internet, all internet-based. That's where you instantly get low-resolution images. They're all over the place. Because it takes a lot of time to format and, you know, really compress an image down to the limited color palette. So the games are great just because of the colors and the shapes are so strong, and that's why I love grabbing. And they are very comfortable to me. I mean, these carpets are just screens from video games. I mean, those are pretty obvious. Just barely tweaked. But I don't know how long that can last. Like, how long can you keep doing that? There's, I don't know.
Do you think there's a culture around artists that work with pixels or games and internet?
Oh, definitely. I do. And for good or for bad, I think there definitely is.
Do you see yourself as a part of it?
I have to be. Whether I like it or not, yes. I am a part of it. But I think, I still don't know what kind of spaces this type of work can access. You know, is it stuck in that? Is it limited by this reference? And that's what worries me a lot. And that's why I think the video game-ish reference is, you know, it's instantly recognizable, but I think it's a limiting factor too.
Mm-hmm. But it seems like you're sort of away from that in a lot of aspects, because they're not video game characters.
No, right.
It's interesting how there's this really formal aspect of your work that is presented,
yeah,
the visual aspect of it, and then there's a very playful,
sure,
even in your process it sounds like you're pretty playful in the way that you're creating your compositions. Does that sometimes cause an issue for you, like this contrast between being deliberate and not deliberate?
Yeah. Well, that I think that's where it's exciting.
Yeah,
it is an issue, and I love it when it happens. I mean, it's always the interesting things for me are on the cusp of, you know, good and bad, or you know, pleasing or not pleasing, or whatever you want to say, playful or considered. But you're right about formal. I mean, I think I went to a lot of school. That probably was the worst thing for art making, because you learn a lot, and that you build your walls by there. So you build your limitations. And so I will always be thinking about making a painting or a drawing. Always. And it's always going to be visual. That's just, even if the product is something exciting and new and different for me, it's still like a painting. All these things are paintings or drawings or collages. I mean, they're everything, all of that and none of that at the same time.
And that's because of school, you think?
I don't know. I'm just thinking about it for too long. When you, that's why I like to do things that I know are wrong per what I've been trained. You know, I know how to compose an image, and I think that's the problem. So I try to not compose these, but they always end up being composed because I'm limiting myself with you know, a number of layers, let's say, on a Photoshop drawing. And by the end of that, I gotta make something that I feel is correct, and it's like this ball of...
And even if it looks nasty in your terms, it still has a visual goodness.
Formalness.
It seems like you've been moving away from these more characters towards these worlds.
Sure.
Or do you see these worlds as just a
big collection
big
of the characters?
Yeah.
Well, it's... I can personify the things sometimes. So I can populate these spaces where I'm thinking about them. And I do these little things and I call them, you know, mutants, because that personifies them in a way, too. But they're just little bits of crap. But yeah, you're right. I think they're all the same thing, if that's the question. Yeah, I think they're all part of the same, this growing world, or whatever you want to call it, that is there. And I don't see much of a difference other than the limitations that I place on those versus the limitations I place on these. I mean, the whole idea is the same. The process is the same.
Do you see yourself getting rid of the pixel?
Yeah, exactly. I have... Or I've tried, but it all comes down to a unit. So, okay, so where I stopped doing pixels, I started doing these drawings that I called hair drawings. I just do little pencil marks and make big shapes, and they kind of look like hair of people that I know or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that's what they became, little hair drawings. Mm-hmm. But the hair is the same as the pixel. I realized, like, the pixel is just a mark. It's just a mark that means something very specific. Or references something specific, references digital. And if I'm doing something on the computer, I'm thinking, why the hell shouldn't I have pixels on it? Because that's what it is.
Right.
You know, it's part of that medium. And I think I mentioned this before, I love this. The pixel is so great because it's scalable. It, like you said, you big pixels here, small here. It's hard not to see that it's a pixel, but you could make a drawing the size of a friggin' building because it's instantly scalable.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to make more information because it's all there. But these were kind of like the small pieces. I just put them under a microscope. That's kind of the thought of it. So it's kind of that seeing in that, the resolution is maybe a good word.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because maybe we should talk about the 3D process. Because with the 3D, it's like you're now looking through a sort of a microscope at these things.
Yes.
It's like you are inside and you are as small as you can possibly get. And like, I don't know, it unlocks, there's a whole nother world that's within, that's contained within this.
Well, that's why I really loved doing that. You're right, there's another world there. And it's still there when you see it without the glasses. It's just investigation. So you because you have this tool, you can investigate this drawing or this world a little more clearly and find like secrets within it. I think of that when I'm just making a normal drawing, like, ooh, if you look at this long enough, you're going to find something that you've never seen before every time you look at it. This way, it's really going to jump out at you, and it's kind of an explicit example of what, you know, how you're building something on a computer, for example. You're making layers, and even though it's a flat screen, there's something there in terms of a dimension. You feel a space between one layer and the next. I can't explain it, but it's just there's like a sensation. You are able to kind of see into this space of a desktop on a computer. You know, maybe it's 2 inches, and you can really, you're supposed to be able to tell there's a space between it. That's why there's a layer. It's like there's something, you know, that Photoshop, for example, tells you there's a difference between this one. It's on top of that one, but it's all flat when you see it, but it's not. It's very interesting for me to try and explain. And plus, 3D is kind of a new way of seeing art, or it's a new old way. I mean, it's coming back really, really, really hard right now because people have, it's money's in it,
right?
So there's a, you know, there's always like a little,
well, there,
culture,
you know,
jam.
I think it's all, you know, it's also the technology now that it's not just red and blue.
Yeah,
I think that's a big difference.
Sure.
And now that movies are being killed, they have to do something bigger and more visual.
Exactly.
Too,
yeah.
Exactly.
To get you to go to the theater.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't even think about that, but well, I mean, stereoscopic images have been around since there have been photos.
Sure.
And it's not new technology. It's just, it's kind of a, the way that I use it, it's kind of like a poke at that. But the more I use it, I think it's significant. And it could be used, I can use it more. You know, I can use it on these big pieces that are on a wall and, you know, hand somebody some glasses when they come in. And then they can look and try and find things that are in there, because this drawing for Present Group is, the whole thing is not 3D, and not even the whole color. It's all about what is, you know, you have to find it. It's almost like you have to be able to investigate it before you use your glasses. You have to kind of know where to look.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the color is the way that I instantly did that. But
mm-hmm.
I see a lot of possibility for it.
Is this your first 3D?
No, I've done another one in the past, but nothing that I've shown or anything like that, because it was more, you know, something fun. This is a great experience because you have, or your project is giving people something they can kind of hold, they can pick up, they put in their hand, they look at it, it's comfortable size, and they can investigate it. It's not necessarily something you just stick on a wall and see. You know, you look at it when you walk by, but you don't really look at it. Maybe when you give them this project, they see glasses and then they say, my role in this project is to look really hard at this thing that I've been given. So that's kind of a way to enforce that, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Or say, you know, if you look a little harder with this tool, something will unlock.
Something's
something
going to happen.
Exactly. And it's probably a big letdown for everybody. There's no fireworks or anything. It's just, for me, the second it lines up, it's like magic.
Yeah. It's amazing. And it takes a while, too.
It's like,
you can't just be like, oh, I see, you know, there's a person in there.
Well, you trick your friggin' eyes. I mean, it's like an exercise.
Right.
When you're done looking at it, you can't just go back and look at something. You have to, I found myself shaking my head a lot while I was making it, just kind of like shaking my eyes out of that focus. And it worked really well on the computer, too. I mean, I did it on the screen. So I'm building these images and moving a group of pixels or a shape. You know, one pixel in one direction makes it that much closer or that much further.
Huh.
So there is maybe 4 or 5 layers of dimension in there. And it's hard to see, But if you know it's there and you really look, you'll wonder why. Wow, this seems like it's floating on top of this, and it's just because of one little pixel of space. And it's magic. I think it's magic.
Yeah.
It's like, and then it goes back to this idea that this ghost thing, these computer images are like ghosts. It's like the soul. I mean, if you're whatever religious or you have that feeling of a soul, but it's the meat of these images, and maybe that's these things that you see are like the ghost within this image.
Well, also there's these peripheral things going on when you're looking. There's images that flicker on and off, and there's parts that blink. You know, if you sort of like move your head a little bit, you can sort of see something one way or not. And I know I was thinking of them as ghosts. And
well, I like that you saw that, and I love that you noticed the flickering stuff, because that means that you were really looking at it. Because I put, you know, it's like one little pixel here or there can make something really exciting if you like put the energy into it. So it's fantastic. It's your two eyes are tricked to see the same thing in both eyes, but it's not the same thing. It's a slight variation, and that's what creates the depth. So when you can trick your one eye to see one color and the other eye to see another color, then you get this amazing, it's like a fight in your head. It's like your brain is fighting to perceive what it is. So it flickers or it does something weird. And if you don't double it, then it's kind of a ghost. It kind of sits there. Only one eye is seeing it and one eye isn't. So that's really where more of a ghost-like thing comes in, when one eye sees it and the other doesn't. But it's fun. Yeah, I still sit and look at these with the glasses all the time, just because it's just fun.
Yeah.
Even though I know what I'm looking for and I know what I'm looking at.
Yeah, I was thinking that too, is when you first get it and you're looking at the piece, you put the glasses on, and you have no idea what you're supposed to be doing. You don't know what distance to hold it, and you don't know where you're supposed to look. And even when you start to maybe see something, it's just, it's total, it's a state that I don't feel like we have very much, which is just complete visual confusion.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really interesting thing about this project, is that, you know, in some ways, when you look at you talk about chaos and discord, but this actually puts a person in that state of chaos or discord.
Yeah.
I think that's,
and they can dig their way out of that if you just put, if you keep looking,
right,
you eventually it will click. And you know, I've shown the drawing to you know, a bunch of different people, and I can tell the people who can't see it, even though they say, oh yeah, you know, cool, I can tell they're not getting it because they're looking too quickly, or it was too quick, you know. And it's like, you have to try to see it. And it really, even though there's these very small elements that are jumping out at you as being three-dimensional, they are so significant when it actually works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that like two pixels can be so significant to a whole drawing, just because it's different than the whole mess.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a little bit of order in that chaos, but you have to work for it.
Let's talk about the golden tickets.
Oh, cool.
You want to explain them and then tell us what you're thinking behind them?
Well, like I said, I like picking, you know, limitations. And they're, you know, we decided on 64, because that was one of my favorite, you know, hot button numbers for the brush. And I know that we have this other material, and because we're giving these, you know, these are presents, these are things that people are getting, I love playing with that. I love having a variable edition. I love, you know, we have 64, but there's something different about them. So I thought, why not do the Willy Wonka golden ticket on five of them? So they're five that are special, right? So they're the same thing, very same thing, but they're better. So, only five people get those things that are better. And I love that somebody gets something that somebody else doesn't get. if that's I don't know, if it's a mean, or if it's like, you know, if it's not meant to say that you're getting this other thing and it's not great. But I love that there's you know, something that another element of excitement in it. It's like another random thing. And you know, we talked about what else could you give somebody with, like, is the golden piece it's the reward, or is there another reward too? And I don't know, we haven't really talked about that. If there is another reward, I love to give people stuff, anything, right? You know, just give away stuff. Money is always a good limitation to work with. But the golden ticket is, it's cost the same amount as any other piece of metal, it's just different, and that's why it's better. So anybody who gets one of those are very lucky. I think they're lucky. Even though I'm sure, we'll see who gets them. Yeah. I think numbering was a big thing when I'm making all these prints and I'm stamping them and I'm signing them because they're an edition of prints and that's what you do. And I haven't done stamp the golden ones yet, but I've picked all their numbers where they go. So I picked my whole set of numbers and I know it's not 65 through 69 are gold, they're in the middle. So that, you know, an attempt to further reinforce the fact that they're the same as everyone else. And it landed on the number 69, which is just stupid and funny. So I'm happy about that too. It's just, you know, it's like, I've always been interested in numerology and not in like a pop way, like, you know, like Da Vinci Code, where you see these things, like, oh, it works. Like, there's some sort of underlying math that makes sense out of the world. And even though nobody might notice that 64 is significant, or the fact that there it's this, you know, 7-inch tall piece and 7 is always significant, or the fact that it's a golden rectangle, which is always significant to me, but not, who cares if it's really significant to anybody else? It's just something there. It's like a meaningful choice without meaning. Like it's like pop. It's like it does it. You just grab it. Like you grab it and you use it because somebody else used it. Okay. So, you know, the Parthenon is a golden rectangle. So is my little piece. And like, why does that matter? It probably doesn't. But it's, I don't know. It's a good way to make choices. Choices are very difficult, and I think that's all that making a painting or a drawing is. It's a bunch of choices, and you know, if everything's going to be significant, you got to, you know, I guess make a choice. So that's a, I don't know, set of choices.
Out when we saw you at SFAI, we were with Marcella Faustini, who's an artist who moved here from Brazil when she was 19, and something that she said that we've been like talking about ever since was that when she was in art school, and she thought that the artists in art school and even the U.S. in general is obsessed with teenage culture.
Oh yes,
and she said it was hard for her to relate to because in Brazil they don't have the concept of the teenager.
Really?
Like, yeah, apparently that's an American invention, there it's just like, you know, you just go from childhood to adulthood. Yeah. There's no, like, subculture that's in the middle.
There's not even the word for teenager. It's just, you know, adolescent. Wow. Which is, you know, growing into an adult.
So she found it hard in art school because so much art was focused on this time period or this subculture.
Well, I think that's very significant. Their teenagers are like the biggest money spending demographic in the United States. They are so important to media and visual culture. And I like most people I know. Shit, look at Rob over here. He's the same way as me. I mean, it's just like, that's what's interesting. That's what's exciting. We don't have a big war. Well, we do, but it's such an abstract war that we have no relationship to anyways. We want to be forever young, like the song. There was a person at the show. Yeah, shit. I mean,
right.
You know, it's like, it's very significant.
There were like 50 different versions of that song that you could pick and play.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was like an iPod that you could pick any version you wanted of that song.
That's awesome. But I mean, like, it's, Yeah, it's so interesting. Even high school dramas and stuff are so interesting. It's like we have adults acting these roles, but why are we so interested in like these, you know, teenagers? Because once you become adult, the older you get, the less teenagers care about you, and they're the ones that are cool, spend money, I guess, I don't know. But I can see her. I mean, man, that must be very, very interesting. Yeah. Like, she probably, you know, in Brazil, they make art about, you know, issues. there's something that I've always thought about, you know, making art or, like, being an abstract painter, trying to unlock this childness or the childhood sense of wonder is maybe something to talk about. I mean, when something is new and exciting, that's a really primal thing. It feels fantastic, and you wish you could have that forever, but you really don't. You lose it. I mean, God, is there anything that like really excites you, makes you giggle and laugh and love? Just being where you are. I mean, it's harder and harder to find those things, and touching into that in any way, shape, or form, I think is wonderful. And who cares?
And also, you have to be open to that sort of, you know, there's, it's so easy to just be like, oh, sure, yeah, sure. Yeah, oh,
yeah. Okay. Oh, no, well, because then, you know, shit, when you were a teenager, you like, scoffed at all the childhood thing, yeah. Like, oh, yeah, or like when you're 11, you're like, I'm not a kid anymore, I'm a big boy, and like, I'm not interested in childhood things anymore, but once you get an adult, you're like, God, and San Francisco is the city of children. Children with no children.
How was SFAI as a grad school for you?
Oh, I think it was great. There was 100 people that you could be with and bounce ideas off of, and now I have 100 people that are part of my group, and whenever I have something going on or they have something going on, we exchange, you know, information and support each other, and the school in general is great. I mean, it's California school. It's San Francisco. It's la-di-da. It's do what you want and see what happens. And it was wonderful. Put me in debt, like it should. But it was like incubation.
Yeah.
You just sit around and make a bunch of crap and see what sticks and go from it. And the people that I really respect and loved at that school made things, they changed, something changed in them. And whether they're doing like, you know, goofy, childish drawings now when they were, you know, making something that, you know, maybe their markets changed or their ideas changed, but I think it did a lot of good for a lot of people, and I cherished it no matter what I say on a day-to-day basis. It was wonderful. And going to the show on Friday was, you know, it's just kind of reliving a little bit of it. It's reliving the excitement of, in the people. Because, I mean, it's, if you're making art for yourself and for the people who care. Because people who don't care don't, you know, why should you care about what they, you know, you shouldn't care about somebody who doesn't give shit about what you're doing. You should be making art for yourself and for the people who are going to enjoy it. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of that came about from going to school there. So it was worthwhile. Positive.
Who are some, do you have any idols? Art idols?
Yeah.
Or people you generally look to for inspiration?
Definitely. Tom Friedman is my favorite artist of all time. Because he just makes stuff. I mean, he's a stuff maker. He makes these, he's like a Buddhist who sits in his studio with a plastic bag full of cups and makes something amazing. And so I think a lot of what I, you know, the product element or the transformation, that type of thing that I see in my own work, I think comes from him. Plus he's like a perfect grad school artist. He's like, you know, making the last piece of art over and over again. Like he is taking all of everyone's ideas. Everyone's great ideas have already been done by him for art school art. But like Murakami is, I love, you know, growing up with video games, you know, you become a Japanophile. I'd say you love Japan pop stuff, animation, colors. So he is a big, huge influence on me. He's a big artist, influence on a lot of people, but he produces stuff too, and he works and he makes product. And Coombs, the same way, makes product. And in the city here, there's a guy, Takeshi Murata, filmmaker, or videographer, that does these fantastic mutations of old film and monster movies, stuff like that. God, I love Devendra Banhart, but I like his music more than his art. But he's even his drawings, I think, are fantastic. He's a big influence. Probably more than I can.
Yeah.
Obviously, everybody just eats art like crazy. I mean, and you get sick of it the second after. And that's why I need something kind of nasty and punky. And there's a lot of people doing that stuff out there. That's really good stuff.
All right. What's the value of art?
This is a big question.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this and... I mean, the literal value is whatever somebody wants to buy it for. But I think why I'm doing what I'm doing, what I think a lot of people do, is you're trying to, like, human beings are trying to do stuff. And we're trying to do everything that can be done. And art is one facet of that. So the value is progression. So every piece of art that's a new idea is another step towards doing everything, even though it's unattainable. And I think it's the same goal that science has. You're trying to know everything or do everything. It's just another way to reach that goal. So for general public, I think the value is that it's answering and asking all the questions. For me, the value is it's cathartic, and I myself want to see everything that I can possibly think. I want to do everything that I've ever wanted to do. And that's why I'd love to have somebody to produce. I love to print stuff because printing is the quickest way to get it done. Or hire, man, if I could hire somebody, be another way to get things done, and so you can move on to the next. Because I really don't care to work anyway. that's just comes with territory. You have to work, but God, if I didn't have to work, it'd be very nice.
But do you think you'd actually be able to do that?
No, probably not.
Wouldn't you just keep yourself busy and work in other ways?
Probably.
I feel like most artists...
They always find...
You have to have a drive to just...
Well, this is...
I mean, maybe.
This is... I write down my ideas a lot of the times, but I never look at my old notes because... I don't have enough time to do everything, and the only things that I want to do are the things that I can still remember. Mm-hmm. So if they're good enough to keep remembering them, then then they make the cut. That's the first cut. So I don't want to look at my old notes and say, oh, what a great idea. It's like, no. I just don't have time to do it.
Yeah.
Or money. I mean, there's value right there. I mean, it's, you pay somebody to make this. So I paid whatever amount, X amount of dollars to make this. It's at least worth that.
Maybe.
Hopefully. I don't know. I mean, I hope so.
You devalued those pieces, blank pieces of metal.
Exactly. Yeah, it's terrible. I'm going to give them away. But, I got a collection of shit here. And, I don't know, maybe I can give them away. I'd love to trade them. I wish more people would go for trades. Maybe I don't ask enough.
Yeah.
But, just disseminate it. But it is always cool to find a stack of old things that you've forgotten about. That was cool. But I obviously thought it was stupid at the time, or I wouldn't have forgotten about it, or I got sick of it and bored of it. Because they said once you finish something, it's like dead. It's time to move on to the next one. The only thing that's important is what you're doing now. At least for me. That's why I take shitty pictures of like art.
I guess one thing we didn't ask was why all these different substrates and what interests you about printing on different materials and presenting these digital things in different
Well, I think there's like a 80s suburbia thing where like when you live in the suburbs, you just collect stuff and you got stuff all around you, and when I'm making this work, I have a choice to make stuff. It's not, if I had to make a painting after painting, it just wouldn't work. It just would get boring for me. We're so inundated. I'm so inundated, and I like seeing so much stuff. If I see that I can make something out of Shrinky Dinks, I have to make it out of Shrinky Dinks, because it's like filling those possibilities. It's like fitting every little niche of production that's out there. If I could do that, that would be great. It's like the tchotchka people that put your logo on your hat and your pin and your pen and a calculator and your jeans. I mean, that would be, that's perfect for me. Make everything. If I can make everything, a whole city of nothing but my art. It's like megalomaniac type of thing. But that's shit, because it's these pixels, they can grow to any size. I don't have to worry about resolution because I don't care. Every time I make something, somebody calls me and says, "Oh, your image is all pixelated." And I'm like, that's the point. And when I send them the art, I say, it's pixelated. That's the point. And I always get those calls like, do you really want this? And sometimes I think, shit, is that, maybe I shouldn't. Like, maybe I should listen to these people. But yeah, it's about doing everything. And I think that's why a lot of people make art. But everybody fits into a niche. Like I do, like Rob is doing paintings of action figures. So that's Rob. But what if you're an artist that has, like your art is, you know, 100 artists' art. So you become like the producer, and you're, how do I explain this? Your main concept is filtered through these different means. And for me, I'm the producer, and it's filtered through production means. And whatever, if that's hand-done or done by a computer, done by a machine, done by this or that, it doesn't matter. It's done. The fact that it's done or it's made is the important thing. No, I have a lot of garbage. And I'm like a good old American.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was fun.
Thanks for listening to The Present Group interviewing Matthew Sella. This interview was recorded on May 16th, 2010. And the music you're listening to was Sabita Tobriano Daihachi Tengoku by the Japanese band YMCK.